Thank you. If you'll make your way toward the microphones, and I guess we will start on our line as usual. John?
Yes, Ken. George, John Bodden from Bozeman, Montana. Good to see you again. I hope we'll see you at the Mount Pelerin meetings. And
I don't think I get invited. I'm not an economist.
I will be happy to.
Economists don't like me.
I will be happy to invite you. But let me try to ease, if I may. Ken, how much time do you want me to take? I wasn't planning to do this, Ken, but I'm gonna try to help you like economists better, and then they will like you better. And it's very, very simple on this entrepreneurship deal. I have systematically gone through the text and saw which text, economics text, the intro text, dealt with economics. Now, with entrepreneurship. And I believe that Alchin and Allen remains the gold standard of economic text. And if you look in the index, I think you find the word entrepreneurship is not even in it. Okay, but let me try to explain to you why that's the case. Economists in general are in fact smart enough to understand the importance of entrepreneurship. But rewards within the discipline come from modeling and doing mathematical stuff. And you cannot model entrepreneurship. It'd be like you can model a chess game, but try to imagine doing that if you had a joker. It'd be absolutely impossible. And so that's the problem that economists have in dealing with entrepreneurship. There's simply no way to model it, and hence you will not get your papers put in the best journals, and hence they tend to ignore it. But they really do know better, George. I promise that's the case. They really do. I really went in to talk to Professor Harberger. I was so taken with your discussion about Chile. We spent time there, of course, at the last Mount Pelerin meetings two ago. But I'm also interested in the University of Chicago and the great contribution that the Farm Bureau of Iowa made to the University of Chicago. That's a story that I'm afraid is not well known. And given this is the 40th anniversary of the Philadelphia Society, I think you could help us a good bit by telling that one wonderful story. And Ken, Ken Arrow was the outlier. He went to the University of Michigan. But tell us about the rest of it, if you would, please. Ken, thank you.
I'll try to tell that story real fast. T.W. Schultz was the chairman of the department at Iowa State University for a number of years. And this was toward the end of the Great Depression. And he managed to assemble there a wonderful faculty that nobody would read, could believe would go to a place like Ames, Iowa. But he had George Stigler there, he had Margaret Reed, he had Albert Gaylord Hart, Michael Modigliani, goodness knows, great people. And it was at the beginning of the war, and they did research and had papers published and stuff like that. And Oswald Browning, who later went to Minnesota, wrote a paper concerning oleomargarine. And the only thing that paper did that was wrong was pretend that the nutritive capacities of oleo were approximately equivalent to those of butter, which in Iowa, a dairy state, was absolutely anathema to the forces that be. And as a consequence, they were trying to withhold the publication of this paper as an Iowa state document. And this caused such a row that T.W. and many of the others ended up leaving Iowa State University, and that's how T.W. got the job.
All right, shall we go to the left then?
Edward Giles. Mr. Gilder sort of touched on something that's of real interest to me, which is the problem of Social Security. It's an institution that is so antithetical to market economics and conservatism. And I have two questions. One is, is there any hope that we will get out from under this institution? And the second question is, has anybody ever done a study to get an idea of what would happen to our economy if it was in fact privatized? And incidentally, I have to say that I do disagree with you, Mr. Gilder, about the idea that retirees will, you know, extend their stay in the workforce. I know of people who would love to retire 10 years earlier, so I think we'd have a hard time finding people to sustain the system even longer, but.
I think that some incremental erosion of Social Security with various private pension programs and devices is desirable, and that that will happen over the years, but I think it, for Republicans to directly attack the Social Security system is very stupid, and that it generally doesn't yield any benefits at all, actually results in triumph of bad economics.
To the right.
Yes. This is for, well, first, my name is Robert Gordon of the Lincoln Legal Foundation here in Chicago. This question is Professor Harberger, and the problem I see is that with the left and socialists teaching anti-Americanism and anti-capitalism on the college campuses, it just seems to me that we face a cross current in the fight for economic liberty. One of the things that I learned early on in my days in the Young Republicans is that without political freedom, there is no economic freedom, and without economic freedom, there is no political freedom. And yet there seems to be a disconnect on the college campuses about political freedom and economic freedom. Just how are we going to reach the young people in espousing the conservative principles of economic freedom?
Well, we heard at lunch that the younger generation has embraced capitalism, and I think that that is broadly speaking true of the younger generation after they enter the labor force and get out there in the real world and start accumulating assets of various kinds and wanting to spend their money, spending $5 for a cup of coffee at Starbucks, among other things. I think you're entirely right in terms of the undercurrent, and nothing is more clear than that every time the International Monetary Fund and World Bank have a meeting, there you need to bring out 1,000 policemen to control the crowds of demonstrators who are demonstrating on a basically anti-market story. But I think there's a great piece of hope there, certainly my piece of hope, that I know of nobody who tells that anti-market story who has an alternative. That these are people who are expressing malaise, but they don't have any alternative. And as long as that is true, I think our institutions and our ideas are pretty safe.
I thought I'd add just a small correction to something that my friend George said. I'm the only person here who's both a senior fellow with George, and we both work for Bruce here at the Discovery Institute, but I'm also an adjunct scholar at Cato. And I probably write more economics, I think, for Discovery than perhaps even George does, and I write a lot of economics for Cato. It's all the same thing. We're all supply-siders. I did a piece called The Deficit Bugaboo, I guess about 6 weeks ago, in the Wall Street Journal. And I think Bruce was happy with it. I know Ed Crane was very happy with it. It laid out what George basically said. Regulation Magazine is an offshoot of Cato. I have no doubt what you said was in the article is you've correctly referred to the article. I haven't seen the article yet. And if it's the way you said it was, I'll make a nasty note to Ed Crane about it, but I'm sure Ed hasn't seen the thing yet or didn't see it before it was published, because we do have a big consensus in Washington, and some of us have worked very hard in recent years. I serve on a number of the boards, Heritage, Cato, Discovery, CEI, American Enterprise Institute, so forth, on the key economic questions, including this question of deficit, both the federal budget deficit and the view of trade deficits. You have trade deficits when you're rapidly growing. We all agree on those fundamentals. And we developed a very good working relationship and consensus in Washington. And I know many of you have been involved in this. So this is one area I like debate within the movement. But on these key facts, the major organizations that deal with economic policy are unified in agreement, and they have the views that George and I have.
I think that, I mean, I could, you know, be captious, but I won't. I mean, I think there is this really was a major, the lead article over 20 pages of this.
Who wrote the article, George?
Some law professor somewhere, Serviano or something. I can't remember what his name was. Anyway, it doesn't. It's the preoccupation with spending rather than regulation and tax rates. A preoccupation with, I think, is perverse, because I don't think under our existing political structure it's possible to really cut spending. And so the effort to cut spending always results in the restriction of spending on defense and national security. And that's almost the inevitable consequence of a preoccupation with the deficit is somehow a signal of the success of economic policy. And you know, it's a matter of nuance. I completely agree with you that most of the time on virtually all economic issues, I tend to agree with Cato. So I'm not, I agree with what you said.
All right, now, we're just about out of time, so we'll take the three questions that are the three still standing and no none after that. We'll go to the right.
Mario Fantini Cespedes. I hope I don't get kicked out, but I'm a Vermonter and a former World Bank employee in Bolivia. I know the foreign policy session's tomorrow, but I can't resist asking this of Professor Harbinger. You spoke wonderfully of the miracle in Chile and how you helped form generations of Chicago boys down there. And you spoke of September 11th, the other September 11th, 1973, when the general gave the international left a big black eye. But what can be done in Bolivia? How do you find another generation of economists? They're all statists down there. And worse, Bolivia is now in the crosshairs of Hugo Chavez and former Shining Path guerrillas. Your comments, please.
Well, I think that, I'm a believer in originals. I am a believer in temptation, that people succumb to temptations of various kinds. And the populist temptation is one of them, just like the protectionist temptation. How many times have economists killed the protectionist snake? And it still keeps sprouting a new head and coming up to bite us again, you see. I think the populist snake is like that, and I think what happened in Bolivia is a perfect example. I mean, they had a wonderful president, market-oriented president, doing good things for the country, making a contract to sell its natural gas in the world market to elevate the economy of the country. And this was viewed by the Bolivian populists as selling the national patrimony, and they forced this wonderful president to resign, and they condemned that. By that time, the people who had made the contract had bought it, I think, from Indonesia or some other place, so they lost the contract, and they condemned themselves to, I think, a miserable period of bad economic policy as a result. Tough luck.
This question is addressed to Mr. Gilder. My name is Fred Clark from La Jolla. Two questions. Number one, in terms of what we heard earlier about the biggest challenge in an affluent society is decadence, and markets tend to serve upper needs and lower needs of the human being. And I think of pornography as being a big business. That's entrepreneurial. We've got entrepreneurs doing that. And I was always struck by a comment by the president of AT&T talking about how now they don't feel bad about owning a pornographic channel where 20 years ago they couldn't have done that. What is going to happen to capitalism as we push religion out of the public square? And if you could address that, you can look at companies like Cisco that freely sell their products to China without asking any moral questions of whether they should sell products that might hinder the United States. And question
that last point, I didn't get that last point.
The last point being that sometimes executives will make decisions without asking the moral question, is this something that we should be selling and should we be selling to this customer? I think of Schwartz, Bernard Schwartz, who's freely sold defense technology to China without asking the moral question, should we be doing that? But the second question is what tends to happen in markets, as you know, as an entrepreneur starts a company, as it grows, it transforms to a more mature company. More mature companies like to, rather than create, they like to dominate markets. Like you can take Microsoft, for example. What is the answer? Because so many entrepreneurs, when they get to a certain level, tend to sell out the bigger companies in order to liquefy their assets. And if you could comment on your comment that we can't have ordered liberty without God, but we're shoving God out of the public square, what does that mean for capitalism?
I agree with the principle that in one of the themes of my speech was the indispensability of a hierarchical vision of the universe with God and at the top. And the moral order is critical to capitalism. And successful capitalists in the end serve the moral order or they subvert capitalism. And so capitalists who promote decadence destroy their own market. You know, they end up reducing the total wealth of the society, which is why I think that the moral structure in which capitalism proceeds is indispensable. I think China is just an immense opportunity. They're more capitalist than we are in all their free zones now. And the real question is how we will respond to a world where our competitors are more capitalist than we are, rather than, as in the past, constantly abusing themselves with socialism. So I think China is a very positive environment. The Taiwanese understand it better than we do. The Taiwanese are heavily investing in China, in the mainland of China. And I think that we have to maintain our defenses, but most of the trade restrictions usually end up restricting American companies trying to expand their markets into the largest, what will be the largest economy in the world. And I think it's just a mistake for the government to try to restrict that. I don't know what Cisco was doing. Cisco was suing Huawei for stealing their intellectual property. And they seem to be prevailing in that suit.
My final question. By the way, after this last question, the panel will conclude. There's a coffee break outside, which will go on until 4 o'clock when we resume in this room. Final question.
Hi, Joe Sullivan. Actually, a comment that you just made about constantly abusing themselves of socialism kind of begs the question that I was going to ask in the first place, which is another focus on the question about Bolivia. And if we look back historically, things were really, really bad in Chile under the socialists, and they weren't too good under the military control until your crowd and their ideas took hold. And then Chile became a good place and a show place for South America, and we all had hope that this is what was going to take hold. And so I ask you, so it's a very perplexing thing. Why is not the left, since these Chileans lived through this, many of them, I realize there's a generation that didn't, but since these Chileans lived through this, they have memories of this, why is not the left in complete disrepute? Why are they willing to collaborate with the persecution of Pinochet when he goes to get his back operated on? And why are there now socialist governments in Chile, even if they're mild form? What does this do to concepts of human rational behavior? This is very strange. I'd really like your views on this.
Well, I think that my own private opinion is that there is good economic policy and mediocre economic policy and bad economic policy. And there are governments of right, left, and center. And we have many examples of all types, right, left, and center, doing good, indifferent, and bad economic policy. I don't see that there is a historic or any other connection between whether where you are in the political spectrum and whether you are pursuing a good economic policy. Now, what is true is if you think left means the government does everything, then it's linked to bad economic policy. If you think that left is government ownership, like the old socialists said, then that's bad economic policy. But the socialist governments and left-wing governments that I was talking about that do good stuff are privatizing, and they're doing the things that Milton Friedman said a government should do. So I think we just have to get used to the idea. You might think of it this way, that here you had a political spectrum that ran like this, and now that political spectrum is going like this, looking your way, more to the right, so that the left of the political spectrum here is where the right used to be. And the right may be more free market than the right ever used to be. That would be my hope, and it would be a way to answer your question, because I certainly applaud these movements. And I was noting down, you see, we do have governments that are doing bad economic policies even today. But if you think about the last two presidents in Brazil, when Cardoso became president, he was a raving leftist. And he introduced all kinds of market reforms. And now comes Lula, and everybody was scared as the devil about Lula, what he was going to do, and he has pursued a reasonable economic policy. I wouldn't say that he has declared himself sufficiently that we can say he gets a B or an A, but he certainly hasn't got himself a D or an F as yet, and there is good reason to hope in his case. So I think that people do learn from experience, and that as one learns, I used to be did quite a lot of work in Central America around the turn from the 80s to the 90s in connection with various presidential elections that were taking place there at that time. And we were trying to persuade political parties. This was before an election. We were working as a team trying to sow seeds of good market-oriented ideas with the different parties, not knowing who was going to win. And we were trying to sow the seeds that a tariff that ranged from 10% to 40% would be a sensible target for them, because they had tariffs that were much higher than that, and they could get them down into that range. And all we got was resistance. And 5 years later, practically in the whole region, the range was from 0 to 20%. So something happened that a lot of different governments in that area got convinced to do something that previously seemed almost unthinkable to them as a consequence of looking around the world and seeing the success that freer trade was giving to other people.